Last night I dreamed that Jack Lemmon was about to conduct a music experiment on me, except he was really Manfred Eaton, a cybernetic music investigator whose speculatively audacious proposals, strikingly amenable to control logics, had seized my attention, irresistibly egged on by the apocryphal haze that doggedly stalked his endeavors. We were in the control room of the nuclear plant at the core of the China Syndrome, a film depicting a partial meltdown in which Lemmon played a shift supervisor. Uncannily, the thriller was released March 16, 1979, 12 days before a partial meltdown paralyzed the Three Mile Island nuclear generating station near Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, on March 28, 1979. It was an eminently hyperstitional scenario, familiar to our psychedelic times, in which overheated speculation engenders the event itself. Or was it a plagiarism by anticipation? Regardless, the features of real and filmic analogs were eerily proximate, from the initial indicator glitch that entailed increasingly overcompensatory measures to the media management undertaken after the accident. Evidence of temporal tampering by occult agents? Who knew? Watch for signs of latch-up, okay? Lemon Eden was warning me about the dangers of becoming excessively entrained within the feedback circuit in which I was a key node, my biopotentials effectively commandeered by an impressive array of sophisticated-looking equipment. A robust loop can overpower the subject, leading to an inability to withdraw, loss of consciousness opening onto a terminal state. As Lemon Eden calmly apprised me of this doom scenario, I took the opportunity to scrutinize him more closely. His face and physical demeanor, though intractably unstable, hovered around a mixture of the genial actor and a heretofore forgotten door-to-door salesman who had unloaded a vacuum cleaner on me, the one I practiced piano with. Having appropriated Glenn Gould's desperate technique of masking the sonorous result into physical activity in order to break neurotic feedback loops that frequently threatened to paralyze a performance in its tracks, I could not resist availing myself of this particular appliance for the prodigious noise it expressed. Moreover, Lemon Eden was speaking in PAL voice, unsurprisingly, given I had just watched the China Syndrome in that format. The European Standard's temporal resolution, affecting NTSC material with a 4% speed-up, magically invested him with extra intelligence and authority, his already concatenated insights arriving with an alacrity that gave no quarter. Hence the speed of the quotes there. Read this. He handed me an untitled sheet of music. It took an extra moment to confirm it was the work of Scriabin, the composer's idiosyncratic notation always temporarily delayed internal listening. The effort had paid off. Lemon Eden had slyly induced a lucid dreaming state by getting me to read and therefore hear music. It was a fail-safe hack, more efficient than staring at my hands had ever been. "Look again," he said. Something was off. It was the beginning of the seventh sonata, the White Mass, spliced to its conclusion, the whole piece condensed from 22 pages into one, a wormhole. "You're getting it. You need to loosen your sense of time as well as pitch." He abruptly shifted tone. "These are emissaries from another world where things work differently. The hypermuzak that you are will recognize and appreciate that." Without warning, "Have You Never Been Mellow" by Olivia Newton-John punctually cut in just before the first vocal entrance. "It's a control," Lemon Eden whispered, suddenly beside me. "Such a nice tune. Perfect for establishing your melodic propensities. Pinging your consciousness field to adumbrate your system's history and processing style. Ferreting out the concepts that produce the singular habits that grip you. Three words, how you stabilize. Have you never been happy just to hear your song?" Electrodes were affixed to my scalp, arms, fingers, and chest. Lemon Eden was back at the controls, adjusting what appeared to be a primitive EEG machine. Although there exist separate functional systems for perceiving pitch, timbre, rhythm, and so forth, the musical networks of the brain work together in such a way that one parameter of an entity cannot be significantly modified without forcing consequent ratcheting changes in all the others, soon resulting in a dissolution of musical identity. Impairments to each of these systems yield wildly disparate, unpredictable, non-standard musical perceptual syndromes, depending from which parametric position the domino effect is set off. He added, "This should be amusing." A strange sensation of being frisked overtook me. It was as if a diagram of melodic curvatures was being synthesized from a repository of tunes stored in my deep memory. I could hear cursory fragments of each in recklessly fast succession. After what seemed like a few minutes, the furtive reconnaissance mission slackened its pace, finally ceding to a monotonous sequence of pitches that I could pinpoint individually. My absolute pitch ability remained intact. Yet the rhythmic instability that characterized their arrivals unremittingly suppressed any attempt at assembling them into a melody, abetted by a now inoperative short-term memory indispensable to the task. "You're processing signals through an impairment to the right arcuate fasciculus, the tract connecting the auditory and frontal cortices, which I've simulated. You're hearing the resultants of your altered brain scrambling to develop hypotheses to ascertain the contour and direction of the humdrum melody I'm playing back. It's a strange attractor, if you will, acting directly on your newly reorganized virtual. In a sense, you're actively composing what you're hearing now as neural backup systems assemble to pick up the slack. Melodies are keys, emotionally valence informational bundles, stimulants closely tethered to daily life. Biomusic is a method for perfecting the channels of emotional communication. The pressure transducers on your fingers are precisely monitoring your effective efforts. The melody is the message. He paused, as if deliberating on whether to censor himself. If you want to force a change, set off a crisis. He didn't elaborate. The experience seemed unreasonably transparent in light of what Lemon Eden had just disclosed. I was perfectly convinced the music was playing in the room and not in my head, as the output of neural machinations. As I pondered this weird deaf spot, the scattered pitches began to magnetize into intervals, monotony slowly giving way to more characteristic articulations. Yet a horizon of consistency was still out of reach. You know John Archibald Wheeler's Doctor 20 Questions game, the one where, unbeknownst to the subject, the object perpetually morphs as it adapts to the questions, foregrounding the subject's associational matrix while refusing to accumulate into a coherently adumbratable thing? Reality is defined by the questions we put to it. Your planum temporale, the auditory association area exceptionally engorged in your case, is being scanned for schemata, sketchy contour gists that would be applied towards future encounters. Just in time, if you will. If Google Deep Dream isn't yet phonically attuned, it won't be long. He chuckled. Lemon Eden continued, occasionally interrupting himself to pore over numerous readouts. One of Ben White's experiments at MIT consisted in probing the extent of contour's autonomy as a parameter whose invariance amidst highly mutational procedures, transpose pitches, backwards playback, intervallic stretches, could nevertheless guarantee tune recognition. Being a cartoon junkie, he was abductively inclined towards hijacking the principles of facial caricature to schematize the boundary conditions of melodic cartoon contour. Take a three-dimensional face space, which diagrammatically includes every conceivable face. Notice how drawing a line from the prototypical average face at the center through your own face point towards further vector coding points yields deformations, caricatures that paradoxically more readily conjure your particular face. Lemon Eden's digression was so provocative that I hadn't noticed the surreptitious insinuation of another melody playing in the background. If indeed it too wasn't a hallucination, which, despite being drenched in reverberation and periodically masked by environmental noise, radiated a curious familiarity. This infective air was deployed in a later experiment, circulated by being sung in crowded public spaces. The gambit was straightforward. Could ambulatory listeners identify it as a reverse segment from Yesterday Once More by the Carpenters, with none of the artifacts proper to backwards playback as tip-off? It was an unusual form of speculative steganography, or steganophony, hiding in plain hearing, in testing whether contour invariance extended to retrograded tunes. You remember the game show Tune Your Speculation? Three contestants each wrote down a secret melody. The house would generate a semi-random set of pitches that each player then steered through discrete contour and rhythmic alterations towards their veiled selection until a member of the audience risked a guess at the liminal edge of emergent familiarity. It was a facade all along, cloaking an experiment tasked with delineating the melodic propensities of a cross-section of folks. It made cybernetic what Name That Tune was already doing in verifying the populace's level of indoctrination and slavish devotion to the latest cultural contrivances. Unfortunately, the true nature of the program was leaked, and that was the end of that. Canceled. Indeed, the history of compression, notably pertaining to the MP3 standard, made it abundantly clear that perceptual frameworks could be productively economically leveraged. Phenomenal real estate lying in wait beyond average human affordances could be and was strategically reallocated to maximize bandwidth profit, all within a tightly regulated cybernetic diagram. What you can't hear, you won't miss, the guardians of communicational gateways alleged, basking in the pecuniary promise of newly liberated informational terrain. And it was future-proofed, a self-fulfilling prophecy. If individuals could be trained to listen at lower resolutions, the stage would be set for subsequent abatements, Mobiusoidally introduced. A broader question immediately detonated. What models of musical experience could be likewise harnessed, demoting these compression grabs to quaint insignificance? Lemon Eden flicked a couple of switches, rote-like. The wandering melody in the foreground gently seeded to a thicker mixture, wet and sludgy, a synthetic composite of uncommonly galvanizing power. Its convulsively variegated patina composed of resonant interference, spatial convolution, and eldritch filtering effectively suppressed melodic recognition. Time was inevitably entangled, its material constitution refusing a steady state, rendering metrical tracking an equally dubious enterprise. Sporadically, the perceptual load inflicted by this generalized volatility was so debilitating that forward motion thoroughly surrendered, plunging me into breathless contemplation of a timeless, infinitely intricate substance. Despite this surfeit of quicksilver timbral and temporal switching, at least two tunes began to materialize, impossibly, as phantasmal resultants. Marvin Gaye's Got to Give It Up and Robin Thicke's Blurred Lines, strangely fused, were both at issue in the lawsuit I'd been investigating. One of the many memoranda fueling the spurious case unfurled a list of substantial similarities, which required chutzpah to pull off, given that a molecular inspection of these, such as I undertook, could not but defiantly infirm every single one. Lemon Eden blurted, "It was a lucky break. Portals are hard to come by. The defendants couldn't have bluffed their way into a multi-million-dollar award all by themselves with a motley array of correlations, each one more gauche than the next. No, their success is symptomatic of dangerously elevated immusial proclivities. But this immusia is not endogenously operated. It's out there, like Proust's Madeleine, which actually contains memory, waiting for the right host to set it free. If anything, our experiment is just extending a process already well underway. People don't really listen to or even like music. By the way, besides being a timbral palate cleanser, timbral arasa, this decoction is also a control, a limiter preventing latch-up." A long-forgotten dream brusquely overlapped this miasma, whose ratcheting, contagious effects I could not stave off. I was sitting in the indie ale house on a busy night, the clatter and chatter of patrons submerging all but the nether frequencies of the playlist. A bass line slipped into semi-conscious range. It was Blurred Lines, without a doubt. Being perceptually paranoid, I withdrew discreetly from a conversation to verify this automatic ascription, only to be confronted by Got to Give It Up. No surprise, the tunes were intertwined in my mind. I checked in with the playback again. This time it was Eddie Grant's Electric Avenue. Each time I tuned to the background to catch this bait and switch red-handed, the tune exchanged on me, like a fugitive virus relentlessly evading capture through cunning counter-strategies. As Justin Timberlake's Future Sex took over, White's caricatural diagram flashed in front of me, the four songs and others I could not identify collapsed onto the same vector, extensions of each other. But this was an inaccurate model. The local specifics were of little importance in themselves, the pitiful claims made on their behalf only integumentary smokescreen, occulting the more nebulous contention of effective plagiarism. The domain of feel couldn't be colonized outright, likely for fear of ridicule. More charitably, I imagined the defendants deliberately prospecting conflational thresholds, steadily descending into madness, dumbfounded as their allegations of fungibility, each one more extreme than the last, nevertheless always managed to effortlessly secure ratification. In any event, a more judicious representation would account for the nonlinear behavior of song composites, whose feel could flip on a dime into another state altogether, by infinitesimally nudging one or more variables across a shadowy limit. Lemon Eden laughed, rousting me out of the nested reverie. "I do my most catastrophic work in bars." He pressed on excitedly. "Of all musical components, timbre requires the most perceptualization, the most neuronal fabrication. Accordingly, it's an accurate transcription of how you inhabit hearing, your distortional profile, or how you get things wrong. We're analyzing that now. Timbre's composite effect, spawned by the idiosyncratic summing of diverse waveforms, registers before any determination of cause or origin rushes in to retrospectively corroborate. Neurological spontaneity is truly hallucinatory. The brain speculates wildly, often inappropriately, all the while ablating inconsistencies and rebalancing timbral constituents relative to prior histories. This is why the transformed are swiftly cross-faded rather than hard-cut. Lopping off attacks, the fleeting breaks in the sonic continuum, amputates a significant amount of empirical evidence, begetting onset agnosia. Cut the transient, muddle identification." Pausing dramatically. "Chameleons don't become, they change. Amuserai. Amusia. A generic term for a multitude of what Lemon Eden termed non-standard musical perceptual syndromes. But there is more to it than met the ear. To amuse is also to deceive. An initiative was undeniably underway within both the ongoing kaleidophonia and the embedded dream to dissuade the perceptual apparatus from directly accosting the putative signal. Nothing to hear here. These swapping routines reminded me of Fregoli, the quick change artist whose name became attached to a delusional belief that different people are one and the same in continuously mutating appearance. Distraction, neglect were paramount conditions for the illusions to fully actualize. The bar songs required a Fregolian affectation to maintain the genericity necessary for background operation. As for the gay, thick hash work, I discovered that listening away from it paradoxically remaindered an almost intelligible, trackable, if somewhat ghostly, continuity. A laptop was now beside me. Had it always been there? On which unfolded in nondescript sound editing software, a torrent of waveforms all overridden with exquisitely detailed volume curves. Transitions between timbre-led mixtures were not accomplished through linear abutments, cut-up style, but via machete fades slashing through an absurdly dense thicket of concurrent strata. It's the program that generates what you're hearing now, playing out the timbral phase space of these two songs, spectrally and fatally confounded. Lemon Eden added, it never ends. At that moment, another music violently intruded, as if joining a transmission in progress. At least three superimposed layers of staccato rhythmic bursts, running at divergent but consistent speeds, were tersely organized into Morse-like patterns. Each layer of impulses ferried distinctive material too timbrally obfuscated to make out, though I could periodically discern a couple of voices poking through. It was akin to a procedure I often employed in live improvisation that bound two sonic strata together, one gating the other. An attack of sufficient intensity would open a window, endowing a tacit layer with momentary audibility. Lemon Eden preempted, brute Morse! Grobal metrical alteration incites erratic fluctuations. All lesional anomalies compel awkward reassemblies of noisy stimuli into mutant rearrangements in a relativist curvature of the space-time of behavior. Decidedly true here. It's a decalcomaniacal procedure. Rhythmic grids are imposed onto these songs to repattern beat structures. This'll clean your clock. Metrical perception is an adamantly esoteric construction, a phantom conjuring of something inaudible, virtual, into a cogent force. Meter isn't really there, it has to be leached out. The whole principle of entrainment depends on a co-creative summoning that you're not privy to. Rather, you're granted the impression of a supernatural consonance with a metrical order that seems to obey your central nervous system's cognitive clock without exertion. Tempest, forget about it. My efforts at extorting a steadfast meter from fraught polyrhythmia, assiduously monitored by Lemon Eden, subsided as a bivalent stalemate gained the upper hand, a mercurial vacillation between two grooves that occasioned sliding mutations in effective intensity. Moreover, this metrical unresolution precluded any endeavor to compile the manic pulsations into a broader expanse, inhibiting by the same token any engagement in long-term temporal mapping. I felt unhinged. Furthermore, the extrinsic quality of the music persisted, even though I'd been briefed on the extent of my neurological implication in these tests. Faulty indicators were undoubtedly to blame, such as the stuck recorder pen at the origin of the error cascade in the film. Manifold representations hell-bent on enforcing a glassy disinterest in these resolutely occult regimes of percept fabrication. How did I even get this far? In a waking state, my neurological backstage remained decisively inaccessible, happily constrained and overwhelmed by the signals of the outside world, surfacing only in ephemeral moments of maladaptation. Obstinately synthetic, meters especially susceptible to all manner of primings and cultural conditionings, my particularly Western deaf spots perpetuating obliviousness to dimensions that observe fundamentally incompatible logics. Holes upon holes, all the way down. Lemon Eden nodded as if reading my mind. Transparency is a special form of darkness. You know the Black-Scholes-Merton model in financial speculation, which ended up hyperstitionally ratifying itself into legitimacy, making reality? Such is the brain. An engine, not a camera. On becoming deaf, Pierce's friend realized that music needn't involve pressure waves to communicate his charms. Now that my hearing is gone, I can recognize that I always possess this mode of consciousness, which I formerly, with other people, mistook for hearing. His insight led me to the very conceivable notion that music in the future will dispense with sound altogether and become an art of induced psychological, physiological states. I began to hear Scriabin's white mass, which had carried me across the threshold of lucidity at the outset. Remember Glenn Gould's multi-track recording experiments, replete with microphones deployed from the inside of the piano to the back of the hall? Scriabin wanted to liquidate the world with his mysterium, thankfully unfinished. His eschatological tendencies favored a special kind of parametric anesthesia, radically curtailing harmonic variety to orchestrate an exodus from the expressionism powered by Darwin's categorical affects, what we know as emotions, instead setting traps to lure vitality affects, rushes and withdrawals, explosions and lethargies, transitory movements. Gould wanted to deepen the game by plotting impossible trajectories and engineering paradoxical sonic realities whose speculative allures seduced them away from the concert stage and its attendant compulsions to steer attention through dramatic time. In his honor, I'm simulating a cingulotomy to maintain you in the phenomenal present. When time binding fails, narrative is obliterated. Any feeling of past, present, future tension vanishes. No more anticipational anxiety or retrospective rumination, just the foregrounding of unassigned effective potential. Lemon Eden was on a roll. My friends in the television recuperation unit were committed neuroformalists. They once superimposed 20 episodes of assorted 70s TV shows, selected for the presence of Robert Weber, a self-effacing yet omnipresent character actor, taking advantage of the standard length and structural shibboleths endemic to the drama to foment alchemical transmutations. Excising everything except Weber's image and voice, collapsing parallel realities and temporalities within a single narrative, they made two discoveries. While the overloaded surface giddily traipsed from one non sequitur to another, the legislating powers of form remained an undercurrent of sense, cognitively tractable, much like the way the brain stealthily polices perceptual boundaries, ordaining in advance the range of possible experience. Let's face it, all cognition can be exploited because all cognition is bounded. At the same time, this concatenation discharged untold affect, so many weak signals amplified into palpability. Coincidences and deja vu glitches similarly secreted on an unusually intensified scale, typical when alternate universes are temporally juxtaposed. If you regulate a process tightly enough, its meniscus shatters, opening the floodgates to unforeseen contingencies. The more the explicit is codified, the more the tacit can enter into play. It was a true maxim, backdoor aesthetics. As he paused, all sound disappeared, exposing my pre-existing, albeit heightened, tinnitus that began almost instantly fracturing into discrete buzzy tones, gradually forming a melody. Instead of stopping there, it began to infold exponentially, as if in the grip of horror vacui. I could tell by his accelerating speech that he knew this was happening. Whitenor's research demonstrated how Whitenor's research demonstrated how pareidolia becomes a normative condition over long exposures. Passivity is overcome by activity as the mind converts tinnitus frequencies to music, establishing dominance. Consider autonomous sensory meridian response and its touchy-feely molecularities. It wasn't long ago that Argentina's military junta subjected its undesirables to the other ASMR, ablandamiento sonoro modulado por retroalimentación, low crackling noises transmitted at unpredictable intervals over headphones dedicated to dissolving identity. There's a market for that sort of thing now. Don't forget McLuhan's observation that art recuperates phenomena obsolesce of their operational usefulness. After all, creativity and paranoia sometimes share the same perception of surplus of meaning. The brain continuously reimagines what it hears in an autocatalytic loop, causing neurons in multiple layers of the auditory cortex to fire more and more. Reality only asks to be submitted to hypotheses so that it can fulfill all of them. Remember how regressive hypnotherapy techniques effectively precipitated false memory syndrome? At the end of the day, the brain's will to coherence trumps veridicality and induces functional hallucination. Lemon Eden had attained the fever pitch of his filmic cognate. In the future, it is entirely possible for the listener to be transformed by the music, whether he wishes to be or not. Conventional music is almost totally helpless to predict and or control either physiological or psychological states in any very sophisticated manner. The problem of the same physical sensory stimulation having different effects and meanings to various individuals will eventually be overcome. Lemon Eden interrupted his speech and began scanning the room, muttering, "The signal-to-noise ratio is too low. Schismogenesis." As the synthetic melodies ramped up their fractal densification, approaching what I assume was the feared latch-up, I mulled over the last part of Lemon Eden's digression. It buttressed a sinking feeling that my neurological propensities were being recruited as co-conspirators in the expansion of control music schemes, the eccentric oscillations and midway stuck points betraying the true nature of unwittingly collaborative venture. I had been experiencing affordable, restricted amusia, a cheap knockoff. Though tantalizing, the simulational ploys to which I had been exposed in a lucid state could not be anything but asymptotically inclined, close but not touching. But even in the grips of pyretic delirium, I couldn't help but appreciate being given access to a perspective, even grossly curtailed, by which perception could be verified, a parallel reality the likes of which had been promised, steadfastly unknowable in waking life. Without any practicable exchange, musical logics could only fold back on themselves, ingrown fungal excesses proliferating eccentrically. It was like the titular...
If the cause is posed, for whatever reason, the fuel heats beyond core heat tolerance in a matter of minutes, nothing can stop it. And it melts right down through the bottom of the plant, theoretically to China. But of course, as soon as it hits groundwater, it blasts into the atmosphere and sends out clouds of radioactivity.
Blowback. The sound of false heterogeneity, inexorably, desperately prosecuted in the absence of any available ingress to a radically other sensory dimension. Not to mention that the idea of excess itself begged redefinition, so integral was its co-optation of a metastatic, perpetually encroaching rationalized exchange. And yet, I knew that alien portals lurked within our world, waiting to be tripped. It was a matter of putting oneself in the way of unusual death sides, by whatever means and on every imaginable perceptual scale. And for that, an as yet unknown set of occult phenomenological tactics had to be devised. Lemon Eden threw a second score at me. a single-page compression of Ravel's Sonatine, the beginning of the first movement sutured to the end of the finale. Read it, quickly, I did. The excrescences began to thin out towards a manageable quasi-warble.
Backup systems, two backup systems, two backup systems.
Notational recoding, he said, visibly relieved. He mopped his brow, catching his breath. The absolute rule of thought is to return the world as it was given to us, unintelligible. And if possible, to return it a little more unintelligible, a little more enigmatic. The anosognosic hasn't yet learned their lesion. Lemon Eden bent over and fixated on his coffee cup, which had begun shuddering to a vibration felt, not heard.